something about the pots partition function and a now standard nomenclature, similar there, quantum circuits. So I'll just briefly touch on that. So okay, so the first thing I want to talk about. So I never approached this problem in this way, but I realized you can interpret what I did, something I did in this way. So if you take essentially the same power that went into Shor's algorithm, the same resource, and you kind of jam it into the problem of evaluating the Potts partition function exactly, what would happen? Right? So are there graph instances for which you get some sort of speed up, like some sort of provable speed up? And it looks like there is such a thing. So let me just review. So I guess most of you do already know the Potts model. Just in case, I'll just go over it. You have a graph, right? You have so on the vertices, you have spins, and in the Potts model, you can have up, down, and multiple directional spins. So, and, you know, in this case, q spins. And on the edges, you have an edge interaction, right? It's a typical statistical physics model. And you have a Hamiltonian and a partition function. And a typical question you can ask is, can you find some configuration which will minimize the Hamiltonian? Or can you evaluate, can you give me some estimate or approximation of the partition function? And so everybody knows this sum is massive. I mean, just in this example, there's 20 nodes. There's already 2 to the 20 for the Ising model. There's already 2 to the 20 terms for this thing. And of course, for many graphs, you could chop this down, and there's symmetries that you can use. But I mean, once you lose planarity, this becomes completely intractable. All right? And losing planarity in this case would just be, it would be equivalent to basically adding an external magnetic field, say, for example, which already makes this MP hard to just find ground states. OK, so let's talk a little bit about hardness. We all know it's hard. I'm not going to stick to this very long. We know we've heard these terms, Sharpie, hard, and all these. Evaluating the partition function is extremely, extremely hard. The important point from the slide I want you to notice is I introduced a new creature related to the Tutte polynomial called the weight enumerator. And this is what I use. I use the weight enumerator. This is where basically I jam in that same resource that we use for Shor's algorithm into this problem. And so I jam it through here, and I'll show you. So this first half of my talk is basically explaining how I managed to do this. Right? And of course, the weight enumerator is another instance of the Tutte polynomial. These are all Sharpie hard to evaluate exactly, right? Impossible problems. So I just want to clear up something. So the only BQP complete additive approximations in this setting that we have is the Tutte polynomial and the Jones polynomial. And Arakhonov et al. Have done these results. I understand that, I mean, there's a misconception about the algorithm they have for the Potts partition function. So they do extend their result from the Tutte polynomial to the Potts partition function, but their incidences are not physical, number one. And when they are physical, they don't even know if their instances are trivial or not. So this is completely, it's not nowhere close to being done, right? So in other words, what I'd be really interested in understanding is what instances of the Ising and Potts partition function are actually BQP complete. Right. So this is still pretty much open. And again, there's my friend, the weight enumerator, hanging out there. And we're going to use this guy. OK, so here's this confusing slide. This is basically, I paraphrase one of my theorems here. And so let's just go through the important parts here. So the important part here is this.
It's
what happens is once you move to physical instances, their technique to prove BQP completeness fails because their technique relies on the fact that the elements, like an element from the unitary matrix, is equal to the partition function, something like you're going to see in the second half of my talk. Yeah, and you can't see it from here. I mean, we can talk about it. Right? But you can imagine not all unitary matrices have positive entries. And the partition function for real cases have to be positive. That's it. So can you imagine a unitary matrix where an entry is non-negative? Of course you can, right? Right? So this is what happens. This is why their technique fails. And even the instances they extract, they can't prove anything about it because their technique, they don't know the complexity of the stuff. The tip stuff is solid, right? Okay. So the important things I want you to get from just from this slide is the following, okay? The partition function for the Potts model can be written as a polynomial. And by an exact evaluation, all we mean is we can get these coefficients exactly.
Okay, and this is what we're interested in here. And that every graph has this matrix related to the incidence matrix. And I'll show you exactly. I'll give you an example. And we call it a CMM. This is the cycle matroid matrix representation. Okay, and the theorem sounds something like this. A quantum computer can efficiently and exactly compute these coefficients if whatever, this matrix, generates a certain code. Right, I'll explain what this all means, what codes are. Right, and the code has a dual that is of a specific form. This is some algebraic structure that the code has to have. That for some reason, the quantum computers can see the symmetry inside these things. And the weight spectrum, never mind. I'll show you this weight spectrum business briefly. It's not important. The important part is that we want to evaluate this polynomial that is the partition function and through using basically coding theory. Okay, so the cycle matroid matrix of a graph, all you do in this case, this is something that coding theorists use when talking about graphs and codes. All you do is you just take your graph, you produce an incidence matrix, okay, over GF2, so just a binary incidence matrix. Okay, all an incidence, so for example, edge E is incident to 1 and 3, so column E has a 1 in row 1 and a 1 in row 3. This is the incidence matrix. You do Gaussian elimination, and all you do is you remove some information, and what you're left behind with is two things. You're left behind with the cycle structure. In other words, you see a structure here, A, B, and E. There is this cycle here. So if you add A plus B plus E, you'll get 1 plus 1 is 0, and 1 plus 1 is 0, and 0 plus 0 is 0. So you end up with a 0 column, and this represents a cycle. So this matrix here, the CMM, basically encodes the cycle structure. And the other really important point is that the row space of this guy generates a code. Okay, the row space generates a code. Okay, and let's just review codes just briefly. Okay, so by a linear code, all I mean is a subspace of a vector space of elements. So let's say we take stuff from GF2. So it'd just be a set of binary vectors. So here's some subspace. You can just choose some subspace from the vector space of GF2 to the n. So you have length n vectors with entries in GF2. And a subspace of these finite field vector spaces is basically a code, right? And the notation is this, nk. This means length, right? This is the length, and this is the dimension of the code. This is what a word looks like. Right, so you can choose whatever field you want. For this talk, just think of finite fields. Just think of FP for P prime. Right, or sorry, ZP. So now the notion that we need to understand here is the Hamming weight of a word. What's a Hamming weight? The Hamming weight is none other than the number of non-zero entries in your word. Right, so if these were all zeros, the weight of this would be 2. Okay, so it's just the number of non-zero entries.
Yeah. So everything extends, except just keep it simple, right? Okay, and now the weight enumerator that I've been talking about is this polynomial here. And all it is just a generating function. And all you have is the coefficients ai encode the number of words of weight I. Okay, so a0 is equal to 1. There's only one word where all the terms are all 0. Okay, so evaluating this thing is extremely difficult, and actually it's worse than that. If I hand you a code and I ask you, I just give you a decision problem, is there a word of weight less than 5? This is NP complete. All right, so these are very tough problems. Yeah, of course.
Perfect matching of graph?
I think, yes, I think there are connections. I think through, there is some stuff there. I'm not completely familiar, but there's definitely something.
But it's not totally one.
Yeah, I don't know. I've seen something like this, but I always suspected there was a connection because, you know, you can do these Ising models and you can do it this way. There's something going on, right? So it's a good guess. Okay, so one more slide about codes.
And it's this irreducible cyclic code business. And this is easy. A word in C is just this n tuple, like I've been saying. And a cyclic code, if you cyclically permute your word, then you'll get back to a word that's in C. So anytime you cyclically permute, it's still in your code. Okay, and then mathematicians, now you get some algebraic structure. So these codes have these algebraic structures of ideals and stuff like this. And then an irreducible cyclic code just means that you take a subspace of your code, right, such that no subspace of that cyclic code is cyclic. In other words, if you take any smaller subspace, it breaks the symmetry. It breaks this, right? And we call these, mathematicians call these minimal ideals. Right? Not important. And then don't worry about this. As can be imagined, every NK linear code has a dual code, right? So basically, you have this correspondence between an NK code and an N minus K code. And the important thing is this. If you know the weight enumerator for this guy, you automatically get it for this one via a very beautiful theorem called the McWilliams identity, right? We don't have to worry about that either. Okay, and so here's a necessary connection to the POTS model. So Alexander Barg made this, that picture I had of the Tuck polynomial and all this rigorous. And basically, all you need to understand here is that the partition function and the weight enumerator are equal to each other up to these constants. So what do we mean? Well, we mean the following. If you take a graph, you take its CMM, this thing gives you a code, right? This thing generates a code. And then if you figure out the weight enumerator of this thing, A, then you get the partition function. Right? This is what this theorem is telling you. Okay, so the graph has an incidence matrix. The incidence matrix generates a code. If you get the weight enumerator, you get back here. What's the little n?
Sorry? Yeah. N is equal to, yeah. So n is the length of the code, and it will be the number of edges. And k is the dimension of the code, and it will be equal to the vertices. This C of gamma is the connectivity of the graph. Just make it equal to 1. Okay, now, this scary-looking creature was the time. This is what flashed in my head when I was sitting in a dog park waiting for my friend, and I realized maybe this is doable. And what this is basically, so this is the story here. The weight, so
every element in your field corresponds to a word, okay? And if you want to know the weight of that word, there's a way of doing it. And what it is, it's basically a sum of Gauss sums. And this is where I'm able to put that resource. And this is so the Shor's, you know, I've been talking about if we use the resources necessary for Shor's algorithm. I was kind of teasing you a bit. But really, the ability to do Gauss sums on a quantum computer, for example, Van Dam and Seroussi gave us an algorithm to do this very efficiently, whereas there's no classical algorithm to do this efficiently. And actually, it's equivalent in complexity to doing discrete log, number one. Number two, there are algorithms out there, quantum algorithms, for doing factorization using Gauss sums.
So I wasn't lying to you, right? But so this is where you can jam in this resource, is right here. So all of a sudden you can start. So if you shape your codes the right way, in other words, if you make the length long enough so that brute force evaluation becomes impossible, this is your ticket. And in fact, in coding theory, I discovered after making this connection that in coding theory, people have attempted to use simple Gauss sums to find the weight enumerators of codes, because it's actually useful for something. It actually tells you the efficacy of your code and things like this. So this is where the quantum resource comes in. And so here, this is what I was just showing you here. So you get your CMM and the row space. So the columns are the graph, the cycle space. The rows basically are the generator matrix. This is what the row space generates the code. And this is where you get this connection. And this is just an illustration of that. And this, ignore this. In a paper I wrote, I actually proved that even test, if your graph is of the right form for my algorithm, or for coding theorists, to test if a code is irreducible cyclic from the generator matrix, it's actually, this is equivalent to using discrete log. And so a quantum computer can do this efficiently, this test. All right, just another fluke. Okay, and so this is the classification theorem again. So now we know what a cyclic code is. And basically, it relies on a certain symmetry in that the fact that the code has this dual structure, that its dual is irreducible cyclic. And this is what allows that symmetry, the symmetry for me to use this thing here. So this window opens up in the symmetry for me to shove in the quantum resource to evaluate, to use Van Namasarusi's algorithm here. And I'll show you a diagram of that. The weight spectrum, so the problem is this. The Van Namasarusi algorithm is an approximation. But it's a good approximation. It's not one of these additive approximations. It's a good approximation. And the issue, however, is that I wanted exact evaluations. And it turns out that there's another theorem by Michaelis that guarantees me, again, if I isolate by fluke again, right, if I restrict to these irreducible cyclic codes, I'm able to see the distances between codes. So what I can do is I can just sharpen up my error fine enough so that I will never have a chance of overlapping, so that if a code is here, my error won't overlap. And so I can actually have a situation where I can identify the codes by making my error small enough. And this increases the complexity of the algorithm. But so there it is. Right? And then, okay, so this last thing. So let me push the graph thing for just one more minute. What I discovered after handing this paper to the referees, so they said, okay, great, but we want a little bit more meat. We want something, we want an example. So what I did is I realized that we can use these creatures called degenerate codes. And what these guys are is basically, so if this is a word, let's say 101 is a word in your code, you can lift these codes up to these degenerate codes. So basically the words look like this. Etc. So for example, so they become repeats. Okay, something special happens here. So two things happen. If I know the weight spectrum of this guy, so I run my algorithm on this code, I'll know it for this, but in terms of graph theory, what happens is that the extra room that I get here allows me to get actual graphical representations of the codes. So here's an impossible figure by Escher. And I remember lying there on the beach, in Venice Beach, drawing these pictures, trying to get these codes to be graphs. And it was just impossible to get these things to come together sometimes. And yeah.
By repeating, it makes it into a degenerate code. So you just repeat your stable answers, or what? Matrix?
No, the generator matrix. Yeah, that's right. Degenerate
means that the same syndrome corresponds to different errors, right?
No, I'm not using that definition. No, actually, there is that definition too. Yeah. In the literature, you'll find two definitions of degenerate. Yeah, and I actually imagined that degenerate was this, not your definition. And then I found this. And then I found your definition. I thought, well, I'm screwed. And then I found another paper that agreed with me. And so these are degenerate.
What does it mean?
This. It's this easy. The words repeat themselves, right? Specifically, you have this. Yeah, you need more. Mathematically, is that the lengths divide into the other lengths, right? So you get these algebraic structure in there. I can show you. And it's actually very cute. But the thing is that it gives me extra room, and the extra room allows you to actually that your generator matrices become basically incident matrices of real graphs, right? So for example, in the 5-4 code, you can't form a cycle with 5 edges with only 2 vertices, right? Try as you might, right, you can't do that. But all of a sudden, when you lift up to this, to the 15-4 code, then what happens is you get this. And this is what happens. And there's actually not a lot of work that's done rigorously about graphs of code. I mean, there's a lot of work that was done in the 70s, but it's not really well understood.
And actually, Barg doesn't think, so he saw my work and he thought it was very cute, but he doesn't think there's any systematic way of classifying this thing, of classifying these structures. It's tough. These are, anyway, so that's the first result, right? So this is what the resources for Shor's algorithm turn into graphs. You end up getting these graphs with these repeated cycle structures that come from codes. And somehow we see this symmetry. Whenever field theory is involved, we can extract something really important. And there's actually, this is the scheme. I want to skip this. I mean, basically, you go from instances, and you just translate around. And then here's your Gauss sum resource. You get the weight spectrum, and you get your partition function via that Barg relationship I gave you. Okay. And yeah, we get a speed up. It's a modest speed up so you get a polynomial speed up in the dimension. In coding theory, this is considered an actual exponential speed up, right? So usually when you think of the POTS model, you don't care about the number of spins. You don't really count it. But in coding theory, these people actually do try to find these weight enumerators. And it turns out that the Q does matter. And you get an exponential speed up here. Q is the Q. So in the POTS case, Q is the number of spin states per vertex. So for the Ising model, it's 2. S is this parameter that you can make whatever you want. You know, change the complexity of the problem, and it increases the amount of graphs and codes that you can pull into the scheme. So if you pick S equal to 1, the type of graphs you're going to get, they're going to be kind of boring. You go S equal to 2, then you're going to pull in some more interesting cases.
It's not straightforward. There's no one thing.
No. It's a parameter that changes the complexity of the problem, but also increases the applicability of the scheme. Okay. I'm done with this. I want to talk about something else. Okay. No. Right. Except if there's questions.
Sorry, can I ask? So there is, in fact, a classical algorithm to study exactly those graphs slash codes.
Yeah. There are. Are you referring to this classical, or are you saying there's another one?
So no, I'm asking. So
yeah. Oh, no. Okay. No, this has not been tried before. So basically, I've constructed a mildly new construction for classical cases as well. And what I do here, in this case, I get this complexity measure by using this awesome algorithm, classical algorithm, for zeta functions. So I can do the exact same thing I did here with zeta functions. Actually, it's an interest of mine to study how we can use quantum algorithms for zeta functions to do the same thing. Okay? So this is my construction.
Okay.
Right. Any other? Yeah.
But where do you see that you have to be irreducible CP?
Where do you see it?
What do you see it in your?
Okay, you're asking me where do you actually see this restriction, right?
Yes.
Okay. For the zeta functions, no restriction. But the quantum algorithm for zeta functions, the complexity is not well understood, so I can't give such a precise answer.
for using Gauss sums, I can give you this precise complexity, and you see it right here. You see it right here. In order for this theorem to be true, you need this irreducible cyclic structure. That's not entirely true. I'm simplifying a bit, but when you have irreducible cyclic codes, there's a relationship between the weights of the words and the Gauss sums. This is where you, and this is where you jam in the algorithm for the Gauss sums, is in this equation right here. There's other codes that you could use this for that have a similar representation, but I didn't want to complicate things. But the irreducible, they're all basically have a similar structure to irreducible cyclic codes.
The Q
has to do with the number of spin states.
Yes,
but in the algebra, it's the field. It's the dimension. It's the.
I think it's not any Q.
No, it's a prime. Yeah, it's not any Q. This can be extended to prime powers.
Is it the power of prime?
Yes, sir. This still applies to prime. Yeah.
Is there an easy answer to how the graph connects to your four words, like you were trying to explain?
Yeah, it turns out that the cycles in your words correspond to the weight spectrum, right? The cycles in your graph, the length of the cycles correspond to the weight structure.
Okay.
This is the correspondence.
So the number of cycles equals
the
number of...
No, it's the length of the cycles. Yeah. Okay, so if you think of anything more, you can ask me at the end. Okay, so
I just wanted to talk about this this other mapping that I've been using to study various things. So I'll talk about the mapping here and just mention a result that we're just going to push out, hopefully in a couple weeks. So what we do here is we use these creatures introduced. I don't know if they were introduced by Kinnell and Laflamme, but they were the first time I saw them, and everything I know about them is due to them. So it's a mapping between quantum circuits. So it's a direct mapping between quantum circuits and graphs via the incident structure again. And it uses these Q widgets. So let's look at what a Q widget is. Okay. So these quadratically signed weight enumerators. So you saw these weight enumerators in the other slide, right? In this case, these things start flipping. They flip signs. And these are functions of two matrices, right? It's a function of matrices and these variables x and y, which can be real numbers or whatnot. Okay, so they're just these sums. And all the sums are done modulo 2. Okay, and now Daniel Lidar, he demonstrated that the Ising, so now we're talking Ising, no more pots, just the Ising. He showed that the Ising partition function is actually equal to one of these Q widgets. Okay, so and actually, this is very well known for people in statistical physics. Not the connection to Q widgets, but this relationship here. And this is due to van der Waarden, where basically he showed that the partition function of the Ising model is equal to some sum over the cycles, over the Eulerian cycles of the graph. So this A here, the A is the incidence matrix of the given graph that your Ising model you want to solve. And the W, so keep this in mind, if you don't remember anything else from this, the W encodes the edge interactions of the Ising model. So I mean, you have some graph. The W is what encodes the anti or ferromagnetic edge interactions, okay, in this scheme. So we thought there must be something to do here. So what I did is I did the following. So I took the following as my ansatz for my gate set. So let's look at what the gate set looks like. Where did I put the shot? There it is. Okay, so I have here. Okay, so let's look at this guy here. Lambda, forget about the tilde. Sigma bk. Okay, so what this is a follow-up. Bk is a vector where you
It's just a binary vector that encodes some operation. So basically what happens is qubits come in. So this corresponds to a qubit, 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 qubit. 1, 1 is a Y operation. 0, 1 is a not operation. This is a Z operation. This is the identity. And so what this means here is you're basically taking lambda times the identity matrix of sufficiently large identity matrix with the Y applied to the first qubit, tensor product with the X applied, so in this example, to the second qubit, and so on, right? Z to the third qubit, and the identity to the fourth. Okay, so these are multi-qubit matrices. They're multi-qubit gates, right? So now what happens is in this case the lambda correspond. I mean, in the physics picture, in the classical physics picture, the lambda corresponds to a temperature. Okay, so you work stuff out. When you work out the whole unitary matrix, what ends up happening is you find this. You find that this matrix element is equal to this sum. Okay, so just keep this in mind. It's equal. This matrix element is equivalent to this sum, with this whatever this mess is. But just notice here, notice that what we have over here, this lambda to the A, this thing is kind of A to the kernel of A, is kind of like this. It kind of looks like this. Okay, so given a quantum circuit, you encode the circuit in this gate set. And then what happens is you encode this H. And this H is this matrix, which are made up of your BK. So here's B1, here's B2. So these are columns, right, and so on. OK, so the number of gates, number of qubits. So here are your qubits. And here's the number of gates. This is what H is. So when you encode in this way, it turns out that H is equal to an incidence matrix of a graph. And it's actually quite simple to see. So this is how it works. When you have this encoding, so the whoa. What the hell? Sorry, guys. I need some of this. Okay. So you encode your quantum circuit. So for example, this is doing a Y operation and a NOT operation down here and so on, right? And these things are all tensored together, so these are multi. So this is not the unitary matrix. This is just the representation. And what happens is there's this block diagonal matrix C that if you look at the form here, if you go back here, the kernel is over CH, and something happens here. This C is a block diagonal matrix, 0, 1, 0, 0. And what this does is it flips all the even rows of H to the odd ones. So you end up with this thing. Actually, you don't. You end up with 0 stuck in between all of these in the even rows. But who cares? That corresponds to floating vertices, to strictly speaking. So it doesn't matter. So it turns out, though, that your circuit representation corresponds to this incidence matrix. So this circuit corresponds directly to this graph. So there's this correspondence between a graph and your circuit. And what happens, yeah?
Steve, if you apply to H, it flips the rows.
No, I just, it moves the even.
Yeah.
That's what this, yeah, right. Just, you can see right. It. I mean, yeah.
And C
is it very important. I'm leaving stuff out. There's technical details in the sum. That you need C. This form, there's a technical reason for why you need the CH here. Okay? Don't worry too much about it. We can always talk about it. But, right? But this CH. So basically what I'm doing is this. I'm interpreting this guy as an incidence matrix. In other words, what I'm doing is I'm summing over all Eulerian cycles, just as in the partition function formulation of van der Waarden or Lidar. Right, so we get this so we get this correspondence, and so what we end up getting is the following. Okay, we get this matrix element, And it's equal to this thing on the side, question mark. I'll get to the question mark, which is the Eisen model. OK, so assuming the question mark is satisfied, this is what we have. We have two directions. Using the Hadamard test, I can get additive approximations of the Eisen model. OK? The other way, if I have knowledge of the partition function, I have knowledge of this element, and therefore, I have knowledge of the decision-making power. I have the exact decision-making power of the quantum circuit. Knowledge of that element is equal to decision-making power of the circuit by, you know, I can show you. So there's two directions that you can use here. You can either use this for additive approximations of the partition function, or you can use it to prove simula bar. All right? And okay, so the but, this is the problem, right? The problem is that in order for this relationship to hold, in order for this question mark to hold, look, this guy, so remember what I said. This encodes the edge interactions of your Ising model. So in order for this to hold, your edge interactions have to be equal to this mess. This basically boils down to solving a system of equations over GF2. And this can be very, very tough. So in one direction, if you don't have any canonical way of understanding the structure, this is really, really hard. So basically what this boils down to is you have the quantum computer somehow is giving you some answer, but you can't extract it. You can't extract the information of the edge interactions. So it's like you can get the answer, but you can't look at what instance you're doing. This is what it, and in order for you to extract this, it can be very hard. But I've been able to prove that you can use Robertson-Seymour theorem. So this is in the direction of simulatability. And what you can show is that if your graph is planar, then you actually, these edge interactions, you can actually satisfy the system. And this question mark goes away, and you actually get it, right? Existence proof. So you hand me a planar graph that corresponds in this way to a quantum circuit, and it's very easy to go backwards. So so basically the conclusion is the following. Yeah, where are we? I like this picture, the quantum junction. So the allowed graphs are planar, and we can evaluate the partition function efficiently. We know this classically. What happens is you get this matrix element. And so these planar graphs correspond to circuits which can be classically simulatable or classically simulated. And then actually in the other direction, I actually have additive approximations for some stuff, but some work has to be done. There are certain graphs, like bipartite graphs, that I think I can actually avoid this exponential overhead, and we can actually get an additive approximation. And I'm actually really interested to see if this approach can get BQP complete instances, but we run into the same problem that Aronov runs into, and it's that, you know, this matrix element, this guy here, I mean, if this is equal to the partition function, it's always positive, right? You can't get all unitary matrices, and so you lose universality. This is where you lose universality in both of our schemes, in Dorit's and mine, right? And but I actually have ideas to get around it, but whatever. And so that's it.
So, are there any questions? What this picture is?
It's from loop quantum gravity.
Hi.
I forgot it was there. Yeah.
Could you go into a little more details about the graph corresponding to the matrix?
This one?
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So you multiply H by C.
No, I get that already.
Oh, sorry. Okay, if you ignore the labels, this graph is correct. right? With the labels, this is not correct. So this is what happens. This means take an edge and connect vertex 1 and 4. This means take edge 2. Yeah, exactly. Anything else, guys? This is what I mean is this. I mean getting these coefficients exactly. So what I mean is, there's a way of writing the partition function.
I'm assuming something like a precision.
What I mean is I can get them as precise as I want. Yeah, I mean, by exactly, yeah, I know this is an issue, but I mean, actually, I can avoid this. I can change this thing so that all the precision gets thrown into the temperature. So then you can say, so the coefficients are integers. I can throw it so that all the coefficients are integers, and so that you can say, okay, I want an evaluation of pi degrees, and then, okay, well then, I have to truncate it. That's what I mean, yeah. The coefficients are exact.
Harry, you've got time for one more question? Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Joseph.
Thanks, guys.